You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Elizabeth Egan from the Human Rights Initiative and the Information Program, and I'm really pleased to welcome Jake Porway from DataKind. DataKind is an organization focused on providing opportunities for data scientists to work with the nonprofit world and to work with data for the greater good, as you'll see from Jake's title of his talk. Jake most recently was a data scientist with the New York Times, and he's been a great partner for us in thinking through what exactly we can do with large amounts of data. What can NGOs do when they have a mass of data, but they're not sure what it can do for them, and how can they think through asking questions of the information generated by the day-to-day work of an NGO to make it do more for you when you're running a project in civil society. Go ahead, take it from there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that intro. Elizabeth has been an amazing partner for us because in doing this work, we come more from the data side, as she mentioned, and that's been very powerful. But of course, to do this work really well, we need incredibly good partners to understand how this could be applied or know the situation on the ground. So I'm really excited to be working with Elizabeth and OSF and getting to come talk to you guys. So thank you for coming today. As Elizabeth said, I'm actually more excited about the conversation that we're all going to have. But to set things off, though, I thought I would just sort of lay the groundwork of some of what we do. And before I get into what DataKind does, I feel it's always helpful to think about what data is, really set the stage for that. And so I'll often ask people to actually think about data, like picture data. Take a moment, just picture it, like let it wash over you. See people closing their eyes. Right? Yeah, so what do you picture when you hear data? Danny would just shout it out.
Spreadsheets.
Spreadsheets, exactly. Probably spreadsheets, yeah. Anybody else picture anything else?
A pile of documents.
A pile of documents, yeah. Like empty documents, servers, or even worse than that, what a lot of people often picture is just the anonymous tube of numbers, like the Matrix, right? And that's a bummer because I even think of this way when I hear big data. And that's a shame because data is so much more personal than that. And it doesn't take much to realize that except to think back to a time before big data. So if you go way back to like the dawn of humanity, like way back in the dark ages, back to say like 2003, when this is what it was like to get a movie. Right, like remember this? You didn't know it was good or bad, you didn't have recommendations, you just kind of wander around. It was horrible. Dark time for humanity. But thankfully, right, we live in 2014 where with the click of a button you can see customized preferences for your movies, Netflix knows exactly what you want to see, and you can make better decisions about how to spend your Friday night. And that's awesome because we live in a world where there's now tons of data. So Netflix is collecting massive amounts of data about what you like, what other people like, it's crunching down those algorithms to help figure out what you want to watch. And of course, it's not just movies, right? It's how Google Maps figures out how we get from point A to point B most efficiently. It's how we figure out what we want to buy, even how we have relationships with friends and how our social networks grow. So this is this new age that's occurring because as we move our lives online, every interaction we have with each other, with our world, it creates data, kicks off a little piece of a record. All of that can be used to understand more about our world. But, I mean, of course, you look at these examples, right? It's buying stuff, watching movies. Like, those are good pursuits. I certainly use Netflix all the time, but there's probably more we could be doing with this data. There's probably a greater good we could look to. And so to set an example of what we could do with this data, I always turn to a luminary of our times, somebody who sort of really understands this world, the great Kim Kardashian, of course. Of course. Now, I know a lot of people are like, well, I don't really, why does Kim play a role in this? And the way that she fits into this story actually starts with the CDC. So the CDC, everyone always laughs at that. I don't think it's the reason you think. It's not a Kim Kardashian disease connection that you're probably imagining. But this story comes from the fact that the CDC is always on the lookout for the next killer flu. They have, the pandemic that could wipe out humanity. Oh, someone calling in.
The CDC.
Yeah. Don't approve of that secrets. Yeah. Data. They somehow got the data stream. They knew. So these guys, they're always looking out for the next killer flu. And the way they do that is they put people in hospitals and clinics and they record everybody's symptoms. And the second it looks like there's too many flu symptoms out there, they put out an alert so that they can quarantine or prevent that from happening. And that's great. Except it takes a lot of people and a lot of time. And so they wondered, is there a better way to know when people have the flu faster? And this is exactly where Kim comes in, because no matter what you think of what she says on Twitter, she's really good at telling you when she has the flu. So here she is, in bed with the flu all day, praying it goes away fast. And of course, lots of people across Twitter are constantly complaining when they have the flu or saying that they're homesick. So a couple of grad students said, if we just mined that information, maybe we could get a better read on this. And they were able to make a very boring but very important graph, which shows that if you look at people mentioning flu symptoms online, you lead the CDC's predictions by about 2 weeks. 2 weeks faster, you get real-time information. And if you even link this up with where those tweets are coming from, you can make a visualization of flu season over the US in real time. Which is either awesome or disgusting, depending on your level of OCD. Virus map. So this is an example to me of how all that data that's kicked off from something as seemingly superfluous as Twitter could be used for the greater good if you really just knew how to apply it. And what I was really excited about in my past life, as Elizabeth was mentioning, is that I was a data scientist, which meant that basically it's a nerd. But really means like a statistician or a computer programmer who can work with data. And what I loved about being a data scientist was that we were an enthusiastic bunch. So data scientists don't just spend their time working on data 9 to 5. No, they're going and doing side projects at night, downloading government data and just playing with it, or increasingly going to hackathons on the weekends. So for those who aren't familiar, hackathons are those 24-hour, 48-hour geek fests where data scientists, developers get together and try to figure out what cool stuff they can build. And I remember being really excited by my first hackathon because when I went, oh man, I'm sitting next to the most amazing machine learning expert, an amazing developer, like this is how we're going to make change with this data. We can build whatever we want. We can make a difference. We're going to do stuff that's going to have so much impact. It's going to be so different. And the stuff that we came up with was so unfulfilling. I mean, we came up with apps to help park cars, apps to find local deals. I mean, it was great, but it was more of the same. And so there's this great resource of data scientists just spending their time making Twitter for pets. That sucks. It's so disappointing. And then on the other side of things, what's really cool is to me, you know, people talk about what does big data mean? Well, I think one of the important definitions or interpretations of big is that it's expansive. So it no longer belongs just to tech companies, but now groups like this Clean Water NGO are inundated with data. And I don't just mean survey data that they're digitizing. Sure, there's that. But there's also data that the government is opening up about well locations. There's satellite imagery coming now to our computers that you can download. I even just saw a new device out called Water Canary. And if people haven't seen this, it's a small sensor you put in a well. It tweets every minute about all tons of different indicators of the quality of the water. So this is amazing. Now all of a sudden, your little Clean Water NGO is basically a tech company, real-time data, and that's exciting because they can start using those same applications that we use to help buy goods or watch movies, except that they have no one to help them do this, right? I mean, I don't know how many nonprofits you know can afford or even knows how to ask for a data scientist, but it's not many that I know of. So we thought it was a great opportunity. We want to get these data scientists who are already working on great stuff, or spending their free time working on not great stuff, to work with people who now have this data to tackle really interesting problems, and that's how we formed DataKind. Nonprofits to build collaborative teams, not just be data science for the social sector. That's so hubristic. The idea is more to build collaborative teams of people who have the problems and have the data, bring them some data science resources so that the data scientists can have social impact, social organizations can maximize their impact. We do it in a couple of ways that I will get into more detail on later, but the basic idea, again, is building these teams that work on these projects together. So I'll show you a few examples before I close. One comes out of D.C. from this great little nonprofit called D.C. Action for Kids. They're a four-person nonprofit that is set out to look out for child well-being in the district. And they were really excited because the government opened up all of these data sets about child well-being. Educational scores, parents' income levels, food availability. And they said, this is awesome. We can look at this problem in ways we've never looked before. Then they remember data looked like this. Spreadsheets. And this is just one that's like hundreds of PDFs and CSVs. For a small nonprofit, they had no idea how to take that first step. So we teamed them up with some data scientists from the Washington Post, the World Economic Forum, and together they turned all these spreadsheets, this, into this. This is an interactive map of child well-being. And what's great about this is that you can interact with this to understand at each level how different indicators change over the district. It's nice because at the high level, you can get an executive summary. So if you're a policymaker, you can read the firm's findings. If you are a concerned citizen, you can mouse around and actually look at the information itself. Or if you really nerdy, if you're really into it, you can download the data that's now all been combined at a neighborhood level, not census tract or zip code, into one document, so you can actually do that analysis yourself. And what was more important to me about this was maybe not the findings from this alone, but the gasp that I heard when they unveiled this to the rest of the other partners in the Kids Count Network. Because to me, I look at this and go, it's like a map. You see lots of interactive maps every day. It's not that great. But they'd all been using PDFs up until now. And just for people to see that, to see what could be done, actually prompted the mayor of DC to come out and say, this is how we have to start looking at child well-being. We have got to start using these resources. And now other Kids Count programs around the nation are saying, how do we do this? Let's adapt it for our work. So that's really exciting to me, that a small little nonprofit could use these tools. Another example comes from New York City, right here, with the Parks Department. And they have tons of data about what they call the urban forest, which I think is such a lovely name for New York's trees. And they have data about when those trees were planted, every maintenance event that happened, when they were pulled up. And they said, we've got this problem where one of our programs is to prune these trees. We go around, we cut down tree limbs that look dangerous, they don't fall on people and cars. But we kind of do it by gut. We see a problem and so we cut it down, but we don't really know if we're making a difference or if we're doing it the most effective way possible. So we don't have a lot of resources for this. So could we figure that out? So what's cool is that they teamed up with this guy, Brian D'Alessandro. He spends his days at a marketing firm in New York that uses data to understand, if I show you an ad, do you then go on to buy the product afterwards or not? Now, the nice thing about that is exactly the same statistical model that you can use to answer, if I cut down a tree limb, is there then an emergency later or not? So he could take the same advanced analytics and statistics that he was using in his day job and apply it to this problem, and he was able to build not only this map that showed sort of an inventory of their trees, which is the first time that they had really seen this. And I show merely because this is a talk, so here's something visual. But what's more important to me was they came up with a number, 22. And that 22 is there were 22% fewer accidents, fewer tree emergencies on blocks where they were pruning than similar blocks where they hadn't pruned. And so this was mind-blowing to them. Not only were the programs working, somebody computed that number. No one had ever computed that number. And then other urban forestry programs from around the country are saying, how can we apply this to our data? How can we make better decisions based on this data that we have? So that was really great. And I'll close out with one last example from GiveDirectly. You may have heard about these guys, either just because you're in this world or they've been featured a lot in the Times lately, because they give cash transfers directly to people by cell phone. They don't use microloans. And one of the ways that they want to expand is to find the poorest areas in Kenya to expand their programs to. And the way that they do this is they go into the villages, they go house by house, and they look for the type of roof that each house has. The idea is that if you have a thatched roof, it has to be replaced a lot. That's usually people who are a little bit lower income level, whereas people with metal roofs, something that's a little more sustainable. It's one way of doing poverty measurement, or estimation, to be proper. But it takes a lot of time, just like the CDC case. And so what they realized was that if you look at Google Maps and Google Images, you can actually pick out thatched from metal quite easily. So here are a couple of thatched houses in the center here, and then over in the middle you can see a very clear metal image. So we teamed them up with some people from IBM and Mozilla, and they wrote a program that, ignoring what some of these like predator-style looking images are, results in an algorithm that can pick out the locations of roofs in these images. So they can find the centers of these roofs automatically. And from that, they were able to run it over the whole set of Google Maps and create this, basically, a poverty estimation map for this region in Kenya. And this was great because people hadn't been able to do this at this granularity before. It took about 2 hours to run the algorithm, all publicly available data. It normally would have taken GiveDirectly 100 days of manpower to go out and do this. So think about that. Before they have to launch their program, they're budgeting in 100 days, 3 months to go out and do this. It's done within a day. Now, they're going to go and check these. They're going to double check. They do not trust, I want to be very clear that in building these collaborative teams, we never just let the machine decide, but it could help target them into areas that they wanted to see where should we start first. So there are many more examples that I could expound on, but I think, these examples to me are really illustrative of a concept that we've been talking about lately that I think is really important to understand how this whole conversation around data is changing. And I'm going to borrow a line from my buddy Moritz Steffener, who's been talking about this a lot. And he pointed me to a book called The Macroscope, which was written by a guy in the 80s. And he was saying, in the old days, we invented the telescope. And this let us see things that were huge, infinitely great, infinitely far away. And that was awesome. Then we also invented the microscope, and that let us see things that were infinitesimally small, infinitely close, infinitely small. But what we really needed beyond this was something that was like a macroscope that would let us see the infinitely complex, the patterns of society and nature that you can't just observe just by being in a room. And I think we're finally reaching that moment, thanks to data, which is now kicking off from all of these natural and societal interactions, where we can start to create that macroscope, where data is no longer about reporting or about metrics, but it's about a new lens into the world so that we can understand and make better decisions. So I will maybe pause there and open it to discussion to say our sort of future plans are to keep this momentum going. We've seen these projects working fantastically and people want to do more. So our quest is to basically scale out to the point where we can provide these services for more people. We've had thousands of people sign up to volunteer, hundreds to do projects, and so now we're really excited to get to that point where we're actually going to start working on those so that we can start making better decisions, not just about how we watch movies, but better decisions about the kind of world we want to see. So thank you. Let's pause there.
So I'll open the floor to questions. I'm not going to take moderator privilege. Please feel free. Whatever's on your mind, spit it out.
And if it helps, I had a few points on, like, I'll just say, I had some slides on some takeaways that if you want to get OSFE about, like, what we've been learning. So I can jump into those right now, but I didn't want to just ramble at everyone.
Let's take a couple minutes for questions and then go back to the slides.
Well, so I was wondering, you had a kind of a mix of different examples, some where the data was sort of highly structured from the government, had been collected and organized, and you could apply, you know, machine learning or whatever to pull things from it. But then I think there were some other examples where it was sort of like a pile of documents or like a lot of PDFs, you know. And I'm wondering, from our perspectives, I think everyone, you know, interacts with probably more with the pile of documents, less with the government data. So I'm just wondering, on your end, what are the sort of different outcomes, or are there, that, you know, that come from that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And largely, the nice thing is, the dark secret is that whether it's nonprofit or for-profit, people are mostly in the pile of documents phase. So rest assured, it's okay. It's like data therapy. But I think, so there are a couple things to say about that. One is that there's almost, like, you can almost always do something with that data. So that's what's been really exciting to our projects. We had the DC Action for Kids example. Yeah, some of the well-being data came from the government, but a lot of it was still like just scans of PDFs, came in ill formatted Excel files. There was a ton of data cleaning involved, but there was a nugget of goodness in there. So I would say that, you know, when we work with groups, we always go through the data cleaning process. I would say in the sort of worst case, where you can't do anything beyond that, that's still an amazing learning lesson. I mean, we've had groups who, they have like fancy database systems, or they're using Salesforce, and yet the way they were collecting data wasn't sort of well formed. But just by going through that process of trying to answer the question, they learned what they would need to do to form, right? Or the group that just sent us a bunch of Excel sheets because, you know, they filter up from different clinics and someone writes it in Excel, they sort of realized what it takes, you know, what they should do next time around. So there's a lot to be learned there. And then lastly, the Twitter examples may be a good one. I mean, there's a big debate to be had about the value of Twitter data, but I use it as an exemplar because there is really high quality data out there a lot of the time that could supplement the pile of documents. So when we worked with the World Bank at one point and they wanted food price data, and their food price data is very sparse, they usually do it by visiting markets, but some data scientists found that if you just went to supermarket websites online and wrote some programs to scrape that data and organize it, that you would get a daily feed of price data. So I would say, even in that case where we walked in, they said, here's the pile of documents, they were able to say, that's cool, here's another data stream that with your guidance we could fill in the gaps of it. Maybe a longer answer, but I think the takeaway is there's always, almost always something to do.
So let me have a follow-up to that, actually, and then I'll open it back up. How do you talk to you? Because I think...
It's a deep question.
I think what happens a lot when groups that work for civil society causes find a resource like DataKind, the initial conversations are very clumsy. They don't know what it is they're asking for, and you're not sure what it is they do.
Yeah.
What's key to bring to that very first meeting, or what's key to know about your own information before you sit in a room with a technologist or a data scientist?
That's an awesome question. So you're exactly right that almost every conversation we have starts with a question. Starts with a question that never ultimately ends with a question, because it is clunky. Like, what is data science? It's still a debate in the data science field. How could you even start expecting people to be able to know how to interact and ask for that? So the way that it works, DataKind, is that it is necessarily clumsy to begin with, but the best thing to start with is actually about the questions your organization has. A lot of people still think the data is the answer. A lot of people, one of the most common requests we get is, I've got a lot of data, now what? Right? It's, you know, and it's a feeling, right? Because you have this, it's opaque and it's this mystery. There's gotta be something good in there. But of course, like any good design process, you need to know where you're going first. And so we always pull people back to, what are your questions? What are your pain points? In fact, one of the most illuminating questions we always ask is, what sucks most about your job? Because almost always, that's where the data science problems start to come out. So for example, a group came to us and said, I'll take the Red Cross. They said, we've got all this data about where fires happened in Chicago, and so we want to transfer it to a new database system so we can visualize it and show people. And we said, that's cool, but like, what's your, you know, what sucks most about your job? And they're like, oh, well, you know, what sucks is we noticed that people could prevent fires all the time. But and it's really simple. A lot of people still put space heaters under blankets, and that's like a real no-no that caused a lot of fires and a lot of deaths. And so we do a campaign where we go out and tell people how not to do that. But you know, like it's hard. Like we just have to go put out flyers. We don't have a lot of resources to do this. And so it was from there that we were able to say, great, so what would we need to target people most at risk of those cases? How do we do that most efficiently? Oh, historical fire data and data from the city. And from there, we were able to work backwards to saying where their data could play in and where other data could come in to solve that problem. And in the end, they ended up with this targeted prediction algorithm saying, these are the areas you need to go put your resources in. That was way better than that database ever would have been. So think about the questions. What's the most painful thing? We're the data experts. You're the subject matter experts. You come tell us what sucks most. We'll come to tell you where data might be able to help. And on a practical level, if you know, the more you know about your data, the more you can talk to the IT person to say where it is or what format it's in, the better it is. The way we usually do this is we talk to somebody, understand the high level of the problems, get a copy of the data, dig in and just think, okay, regardless of the, you know, we're not going to be able to answer the questions about your subject space, but we can imagine what could be possible, and then come back together and say, here's what we think could be done, here's what you know, you know, is valuable, where do they line up, and what should we do? Probably a longer answer than you wanted, but.
Long answers are good. This is the Open Society Foundation's over in the corner.
So many questions. I'm coming from working with the Accountability and Monitoring in Health Initiative in the Public Health Program and with the Global Health Financing Initiative. So many questions about the connection between data and social change, which is the title of this session. But just from your perspective, if you could give examples or stories of how you feel the data is actually being used for change, because I think there's a difference between just informing or illustrating something using data and actually that connection between what causes change and how much that evidence or that data is useful for causing change and just how you have interfaced with that issue. Yeah. And then also I think a lot of us are in the space, especially with all of this open government and access to information and transparency movement that it's happening, where governments are increasing, are pressured to increase access to information. But civil society doesn't always know what information would be useful and and in what format, and to what extent are you helping people to know what to ask for?
Awesome questions. All right, I'll start with the first one on how change is actually happening. I think of an example, I think it's called Climate Corp. Does everyone know Climate Corp? You can help me tell this story better. So the story that I heard about these guys was they were helping come up with insurance for rural farmers. The problem, of course, is that if you live in an information-poor area, you don't necessarily know what prices are going to be, you don't know what weather is coming, and so it's very hard to work as a subsistence farmer. And so what this organization started doing was incorporating tons of feeds about weather data, about pricing data, to provide insurance for subsistence farmers to say, hey, you know, we know that there's an 80% chance of rain that's going to rain out the market, so it's not going to be, you know, people aren't going to show up today. So we can adjust insurance for you, so you'll still get paid. And so this was a moment, like, you know, that was to me, a great program because it allowed them to use all these data streams to help provide a service that was targeted that allowed people to actually, you know, do subsistence farming better. And one of the things that was so cool is they got so good at prediction that you actually, you don't have to file a claim. They know enough about what happens with the weather in town that you actually just get a check that shows up to reimburse you for presumed losses because, you know, a thunderstorm hit or because a crop was dried out ahead of time. Now, I don't know if that's exactly the social change you're talking about for proof. That's maybe more like, no, that's a definite no. Okay, that's a cool story though. You can tell that. I guess, I mean, this is, I'd have to think about it a little more. I mean, maybe what you mean is, do you mean like sustained, like?
No, it's also that it takes decisions from powerful people in order to make change. And to what extent are you finding that there is or is not a connection between some of the data and the presentation of data and the decision making that needs to happen to address an issue? And I guess in our work, we found that there's multiple steps in that causal change between like information and good data and actual change. And so I just wonder what you're learning about that.
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, that's awesome. And actually, it's one of the reasons I'm so excited to be working with OSF, because our work tends to end at the end of the project. So for example, let's take the DC action one. You give the map. Great, you get the map. Now what, right? And we've been trying to work with partners to think through what would the rest of that chain look like. And so what we've been learning about it is, I mean, there's sort of, these might seem like obvious design learnings, but mapping that out up front is really important. People get excited about the shiny end, but we really try to force them to lay out for us, okay, what's going to happen next? Which policymaker is going to use that? What bill would they write? How would we make sure that happens afterwards? So getting the organization to think about that up front is really important. The other is actually finding organizations who already are committed to that chain. And I say that because we're finding a lot of organizations up front really want these results to impress funders, really want these results because they're cool, not these results because they somehow push their agenda. And what we really look for are groups who are willing to hear hard truths and willing to say, like, this may come up with something that is not favorable, and that's actually a good thing, and how will that affect that chain? But honestly, I hate to dodge the question, but I'll turn it back to you guys. I would love to hear how you create systematic change in the world. That's, I can tell you where data might help, but I can't tell you the answer to all of that. It's a start. And then, I'm blanking on your second question now. Oh, governments. Is it governments?
No, it was just, what do we ask for? How are you helping civil society to know what to ask for?
So the problem is, there are a couple of problems here. One is that the government is opening up data without knowing themselves what the data is for. So that's like, it's like throwing a bunch of wood, like random pieces of wood, to architects, being like, build stuff. It's like, I don't know what this should be used for yet. So that's one problem. It's not tailored to a purpose. The other is that people don't have data abilities in-house. So once you get that pile of wood, how would you even begin to assess whether it's good for what you need or not? So what we've been finding is that by bringing together these groups of the data holders, so like governments and social sector, or civil society, and the data scientists, that there becomes this really kind of like virtuous circle that happens, which is great, where the pattern is usually, here's our question, we want to improve maternal health. Great, here's some data from the government about maternal health. Let's use the data science skills to try to solve it. Usually the answer is, we are missing this data, or this data is not good for this reason. But we now know that we could have, you know, what we need. And so that's been the most, to me, one of the biggest benefits, is finding out what the data is that we need, and that the social sector organization usually then understands what's possible and why they would need that data, which is very helpful. We've actually, you know, the government, to their credit, has come to us and often said, they're looking for that help as well. They're like, we throw the data in the ether, we want people to use it, but we don't know if it's useful. It might be, you know, if you just tell us that we need one more column to suddenly, you know, battle public health issues, like that might be very easy for us to get, we just don't know that you need it. So I think that's really what we're hoping to accomplish, is starting that conversation, that dialogue with everybody. Yeah, that was too vague, but I'll talk after.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I really
appreciate it. My question is about qualitative versus quantitative, not necessarily meaning in terms of a flash, but where does qualitative data fit in with what you do? Because I was particularly intrigued about one of the points that was raised in the invitation to the talk, saying why should we be wary about indices?
Don't worry about it.
I work in the field of education, and a lot of what we do is qualitative in nature.
Sure.
How do we know when learning occurs? How do we prepare teachers? Mm-hmm. Those kind of things that are difficult to reduce to numbers.
Yeah.
And I just want to know, how do you...
How do we work with that? Such a good question. There's a much bigger conversation here around the idea of quantification in general. Every time I talk, I'll just share this with you guys too. I always mention this paper called Commensuration as a Social Process. And I love this paper because it's all about the question of how do we as humans have a tendency to take our qualitative world and reduce it to numbers. But inherent in doing that are natural social, technological, and political biases that not just are present, but are so ingrained in us that it's almost that we're unaware of them. I'll try to get back to your specific question, but I think this is a really important point to think about, is that every time we're creating these numbers, we need to think very hard about how that number got there. And I don't even just mean how was it digitized, but when you're looking at stop and frisk data, how many races are there? There's six. Like, why six? And in fact, in some years it changes, 6 to 7. Right? So like, if you just blindly loaded that data and start analyzing and building charts and graphs, like, you would be missing the fact that there are decisions being made at a policy level that influence your results that are very important. So this is a longer, so that's very important for us to be aware of, and I think the more we get people talking about the provenance of data, the better the end result will be. But to your specific question about qualitative, I think, so to me, qualitative data is super important. I mean, you can't quantify everything, and we use it at DataKind all the time. When we work with these groups, we don't yet have like a metric for how much they've improved their data literacy. We're thinking about it, we're working on it, but we start with stories, because that's how people start to understand the world. I think qualitative data is very important in that regard. I think there's also the very like techno-positivist view, which is that qualitative data is quantitative data. So, for example, we had a group look at veterans coming through an improvement program for veterans, and they would write responses to surveys. And you may say, well, that's qualitative. They're just talking about how they're doing in the program. It's not a number. But you could look at things, and it's digital, right? So you can say, how many words did they use? Are the types of words that they're using changing over time? Is their tone changing? So this may not be what you were getting at, but we find a lot of times people who threw up their hands and said, well, I just have stories. There's stuff you can learn from those stories, or that machines could help you understand about the stories. So that's important too. So I guess to sum up that ramble, you know, there's a real like process to converting qualitative to quantitative that we all sort of have to be aware of. It's inevitable, it's going to happen, and we need to be aware of how it happens so we can question it, but still find it useful where possible. And qualitative data, if it's digital, something you can probably learn from it, though you can use it, you can use data science on it, so I wouldn't think that that's not very much. So I don't know if that answered your question, but maybe not. Bigger conversation. Do you want to ask like a follow-up?
No, that's fine. We can talk about it.
All right, cool.
I'm trying to sum up all my questions into one question, which is basically, when can we start? Because I work on ethnic profiling, and so what you just said really resonated with me, because in different countries, the people who are being ethnically profiled in Moscow are different from the people being ethnically profiled in Paris, who are also somewhat different from the people being profiled at Madrid. So, you know, we're very aware of how, when we're trying to track the odds ratio, how much more likely is someone to be stopped if they're a member of an ethnic group, a particular ethnic group, depending on the country, the groups being targeted are different and have to be identified, you know, through some process of basically asking people, who do you think the police would stop, or can you recognize that person as a, quote, minority person.
Yeah.
And so when we were doing this exercise in Moscow, and everybody looked the same to me, but the students who were monitoring it were like, oh, that person is from the Caucasus. You know, they could tell.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, I could tell. And then that became digitized data. But that's not my question.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm too excited. No, what the particular question that we're working on right now has to do with documentation of identity and the link to economic opportunities and well-being. So we work on access to nationality. And even in countries where people formally have access to citizenship, everything is so bureaucratized now, people need ID cards to actually do anything, even buy a SIM card, get a motorbike license, certainly open a bank account, being registered as the owner of land that was never registered before, of course voting, of course getting a passport to go abroad to work. You know, all the stuff is now linked to actually having documentation of your identity. So as part of OSF's work on the post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals, we're trying to argue that documentation of identity should be incorporated as a part of development, you know, as like, you know, economic opportunities are not available to people without IDs. So now a zoom in on Nepal, and we have several NGOs that have been working for several years to help people get ID cards. And they've been collecting data like any old way. So we have 40,000 records in Excel of people from lower caste groups who never had ID cards before, and you know, through the intervention of some program, you know, involving paralegals, 85% of them now have ID cards. So some people are saying this data is completely useless because you have no comparator group. These are only people who were helped by the NGO, you know, and they're people from certain districts who we know are lower caste. And you know, you don't know whether the same number of upper caste people would have the same problem, you know, or the same number of upper caste people could have their problem solved with paralegals. So this data is not useful at all. And so, you know, I just can't believe that that much data is really not useful.
Right.
You know, and even if it is, we're about to launch you know, some new work in Nepal because a lot of people, millions, still don't have ID cards. And the question is, how do we help them get ID cards? You know, we still have a year or so left to run in which we could generate data which would still be useful in this conversation about whether documentation of identity affects economic well-being.
Wow.
So if we could start right now, that would be great.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
If we could start tomorrow,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Give me a call.
Let's get this going. Yeah, no problem. So that's actually a really good point, and I credit whoever was criticizing the sample, at least for being aware of statistical bias. And sure, if you're trying to make a conclusion about everyone in the country, they're right, you have a very biased sample. It's only people who came through this program. That said, I have sort of two responses to that. One is that you have to, you know, if you're trying to make a conclusion about all of, you know, all of Nepal, sure, this isn't good. But if you're just looking at, you know, the specific group who are in your program and who might likely be in your program again, then that's fair, I think, to analyze, to understand, you know, more about that group. You know, so a lot of times we'll have NGOs come and say, you know, I'm using a cell phone program to get people on doing more public health. But that's not representative of the country, of the entire country. And that's fine, because they're not trying to answer what's happening in the whole country. They're trying to answer, they're like a business. They're like, what do I know about my customers? You know, like, maybe, you know, what can I learn from this to understand, are there different segments? Are there people who, you know, have certain behaviors that would help me shape these programs when I'm working with that population again? So I think there's something in that data for sure. The other thing I would say is, and this is a little, this is gonna, I'm gonna take off my statistician hat because this is a little bit blasphemous, which is that what business is starting to do as they've gotten more data is that they've stopped making causal conclusions and started using correlations to drive business. There's a danger in doing that. That's basically saying, you know, two things are related to each other. As one changes, the other changes. I don't know that that's going to happen across the board. I don't know that scientifically this one changes because this one changed. But if it's something as simple as when I send an email at midnight, more people click the links in it, like, maybe it doesn't matter so much as long as I'm getting those link clicks. Now, this is like, this is very black magic-y. It's not statistically sound. However, I do think there's a place for that in some of this work where, yeah, maybe your sample's not all of Nepal, but maybe there are correlations there that are valuable. Maybe you learn there's a certain type of people who respond to this ID program really well. Does it matter exactly that scientifically in every 100, in every case, that's the sort of reason that they're responding to your program? Maybe not if it gets more people in the door and getting IDs. So that's sort of my feeling about it is, yes, there's something there, or hey, at least we should look at it to find out if there is.
So I think we should take a pause there and go back to your slides, because what I'm hearing is a couple of questions in the room about missing data, some information about kind of the missing social graph. How do people fit together in ways that would inform the information that you find in raw data? And then I'm hearing a little bit about the policy decisions behind the provision of data that you receive from the government.
Yeah, I'd actually, so you guys probably have better and more specific questions than these learnings. So I'll go through these quickly just, and we started to poke on some of them. But then I want to talk about those because those sound really even better. So really quickly, I wanted to highlight some of the learnings that we've done, learned from work on these projects with Elizabeth. And one that already came up is that translation is critical. Like, this is actually one of the most important parts for us. We thought we could, our first model was to get data scientists and put them with NGOs. And then it turns out that, yep, right, little more need be said. Yeah, there's, I mean, I remember the first time, I thought everything was going so well. I was listening on the check-in calls, everyone was nodding, yeah. And then they got to the end, and the data scientist stood up and was like, well, the p-value of the correlation is big. And I could just see everyone's face glaze over, and I was like, damn it, what have we done? So really, our role is actually much less about data in-house now. That's what the volunteers do, and you know, we know. It's much more about making this easy, seamless, make sure everyone's speaking the same language. That's actually become much more of our focus. Another thing is actually, I used to think that data scientists only wanted to work on really cool big data problems. And it turns out that no matter what problem we've ever thrown out there, there's always someone who is so psyched to do it. And that shocked me, because I wouldn't have felt that way. We had one that came up was the mayor's office of data and analytics in New York City came up and said, hey, we take addresses and we map them to geographic locations in New York City. And this is how we distribute social services. If you could map to our system, you get a social service. Turns out Queens, anyone who's familiar with Queens, is a nightmare for the system. 37th Street, Ave 5, is like, doesn't compute. And that means if you don't, actually, if you can't map that, those people don't receive services. So they said, which is very tragic, right? So they said, it's not that they don't, but through this system they don't. So they said, would somebody like come and tune up this program? And I was like, that sounds so boring. Like, the data scientists that I know, they want to look at cool data sets and build network graphs. I had 20 people sign up who dove into this for like 48 hours and were so excited about changing this. And in the end, they actually improved. There were something like 5% more Americans, New Yorkers, who were then mapped, which the mayor's office then came out and said, there are now 150,000 more people who are eligible for services because of this. So it's a really big impact. But I wouldn't have thought anyone would have touched this. I would have thought just hire a consultancy to do it. So that's actually been really reassuring to me that people, nerds like doing nerdy stuff. So that's been really, really hopeful. And then the last one that we sort of started to touch on, but is really important, is that we talk about doing data science projects. But these are like such a Trojan horse for us. Like, that's the exciting things that people want to do. It's a great starting point. But the success that we look at is actually not based on the project alone, but on how much the organization now understands data science, has now increased their data literacy. Like, the world we want to live in is not one where we're like a consulting company, like going around doing projects and then you ask for more projects. I want to see a world where like all nonprofits have data science capacity in-house, or at the very least, know how to talk about it, know when you need to ask for it, right? Like, I think Elizabeth was the one who was saying, you know, everyone needs legal help. That doesn't mean you should all learn law, right? So it's not like every nonprofit needs to learn to be a statistician, but you should at least know when you need to go talk to one. So that's really been what we're trying to shape our programs to do, is get people in the door, do something valuable for them, for sure, but use that as a springboard to talk about how you think about this problem next time, how your data goes from being the dump of files next time. So those were the three broad points that I wanted to bring up, but I think the specifics are actually maybe more interesting to talk about.
Okay.
I have a quick question that's a little bit unrelated to that, but I'm just curious about how you identify and understand sort of untapped sources, because I know, for example, like Frontline SMS, which is now being used for disaster response, and they've partnered with Ushahidi, and they're working with community health workers, but it was never intended to be, I mean, from what I understand, a source for big data. And I'm just curious how do you go out there and say, okay, there's all this data, and how can we use that as a source for, you know, and I think that there's a lot of untapped.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm sure we're missing a lot of it. But a lot of it comes from the data scientists from industry think about that a lot, because once you start thinking that way of what is the data coming off of this product, suddenly it is like the Matrix or something. Like, you suddenly see everywhere that data could be used that's coming off of something that you wouldn't expect it to be. So a lot of that comes from our volunteers when they team up with an organization saying, oh, I know about this mobile money market that uses M-Pesa. I bet we could just ask them and they would give us the data and we could understand exchange data. Or, I know about Orange released a bunch of cell phone data. It's anonymized, but it has a lot of location information. I bet we could look at refugee phone. Oh, I'd love to. Clearly struck a nerve there. A lot of this comes from the experience of the data scientists. But you're right, there are vast untapped resources. And the long-term thing that I would love to see, we've been talking about sort of a building in the future, is like getting a data librarian. You know, like, you go to the library, like, that's what librarians are for. You go to the library and say, I need this information about in the 18th century paintings, and they go find it for you. And right now, there's nothing that's like that for data. If you said, like, I need, I don't know, water quality data for the Northeast, like, I'm going to Google. And that's a bummer, because not only is it not registered, but, like, yeah, people are probably collecting that data for other purposes that it's not even known about. So it's a much bigger conversation, but I think a start would be having someone dedicated to going out and hunting it down and cataloging it. It's kind of old school, but I think it would be hugely helpful.
Does anybody want to talk about
the most unsatisfying answers, too? Because, like, everyone I answer is just kind of like, It's tough questions.
So do we want to talk about the ethics of data and the Hippocratic Oath of data scientists? Or are there questions in the room before? I'm conscious that we have about 10 minutes left of the scheduled time. We have the room for a while, but 10 minutes more of the scheduled time. Anybody who has to leave might want to ask a question?
I know you do a lot on data analysis. Do you do any training on, like, data collection, particularly of impoverished communities or people that are in areas like slums and things like that, where data scientists or data collectors are, like, find it difficult to get to? And what kinds of technologies are available to them? What types of tools would they be able to use?
So we haven't done a lot of that yet. Most of our work has been around, once there's some kind of data, how could we analyze it or learn from it? That's, unless it's something like, what sources are digital that we could use to supplement your data? So, like, satellite imagery and things like that, leaving aside the conversation of bias there. So we haven't broken into that yet, but I think it's fascinating. And there are, I'm trying to think of, does Tactical Tech do that kind of work? I feel like there are some other groups that are working on that I'm super impressed by, but that we haven't gotten into yet. But I'd love to hear if you think there's a good opportunity or what people are looking for out there. Oh, yeah.
Open up. School of data.
Totally. I love those guys.
Any other questions before we hit our 10-minute mark? Hippocratic Oath of Data Ethics?
Yeah, I actually want to turn that over to you guys a little bit. I'll lay out the problem, and then I'm just be so curious to hear what you guys think or what you face. This system's really fun. It's great. Like, you get data scientists who are coming out of industry, who can work with nonprofits on data that government's collected to hopefully form some kind of collective action or better decision making. But the question then for us very personally to our data kind of work becomes this question of ethics. So a case that came up that didn't happen with us, thankfully, was on a platform like Ushahidi, which the woman who just left was mentioning, that collects data about a community. If I'm a data analyst in San Francisco analyzing that data about a community that put their data onto a public resource where I'm going to turn the results around to a publication that the government is going to use, like, who is ethically responsible to whom? Who owns that data? Who owns those results? And what are my ethical responsibilities, in any case, in dealing with interpretation? So if I put out a report that eggs cause cancer because I analyzed the data on egg and cancer data. Is it, and somebody makes a bad conclusion about that, is it my fault because I didn't explain my methodology clearly enough and I didn't tell you how it should be used? Or is it your fault because you're not data literate enough to be using it and you shouldn't be making those decisions? And that's something I think a lot about when we make these kinds of calls. I don't know if that's what you were alluding to, Elizabeth, so guide me in if you had something more specific or different you want to talk about. But I'd be really curious to hear the ethical challenges that you guys are facing with data, and if you have any answers, particularly.
And it doesn't have to be big and small, just to add. So for me, the ethical questions that arise with data collection have been going on forever, before there were these advanced capabilities to do more with them, to publicize them, to shout them through a larger megaphone. The question is, once you enter a system that collects your information about a human rights violation that's been perpetrated against you, who's responsible for maintaining the secrecy of that data? How anonymized can it really be? How does anonymizing phone records of locations actually get? We can talk about that as well. I mean, I think don't think of this as a problem of massive data or science-y kind of data. It's really the ethics of using and handing over information about individuals who've been affected by human rights problems.
Yeah.
Does anybody? We could use more brainstorming on the pitfalls of this, because if there is a question about developing a code of ethics for data scientists involved in civil society problems, then we should address it. We should think about it and know more about it. But we need to sort of bring the problems to the surface to really figure out what that might be.
Yeah. I have soapboxes, but I'm kind of curious to hear what other people think first.
Does it depend on the data?
Yeah.
So addresses in Queens, which are public, that's different from accounts of human rights violations. What about tin roofs? Who owns tin roof data? Presumably the people with the satellite. I'm not sure who owns it. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Does Google own that information about your house because
right.
they took, you know, Google Images? Was it information about your house when it was just a picture, or only when somebody interpreted it?
Right. Does the interpretation create more value in the data and more information about you? And should we worry about that? Or is that inevitable?
I don't have an answer to that question, but I think for me, coming from being a researcher before coming into this role, as you said, these questions have always plagued data, whether it be qualitative or quantitative. I don't think we have the luxury as people who collect data or analyze it to feel like we're divorced from the outcome of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we do have a responsibility to be thoughtful about how it could be used, how it could be interpreted, who is it going to, what does it mean for the people who are most affected by the problems that we're studying. Does the interpretation resonate with the communities that you're trying to help? I mean, all of those things are questions that I don't think we have the luxury of not asking.
What I think might be happening is there's kind of an emergence of at least an awareness of a spectrum. So I think the way you presented it was more like binary, like is it your fault, is it my fault? But I think if we think of other analogies where there's been kind of an evolution of like an awareness of like ethical obligations of people engaged in a certain space, like humanitarian actors, for example, if you look at the difference between ICRC and MSF, like in the evolution of being aware of that ethical spectrum, I think that's kind of what we're muddling through right now with data. So I'm waiting to see how that will map out. And then I think people will choose, you know, where they sit on the spectrum.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of the debate right now is, data's bad, shut down, we can't give any data because privacy could be violated, or, yeah, whatever, it's inevitable, just let it happen. And, like, it's really grating to me that it's so binary, because there should be a more nuanced conversation about what are the risks and trade-offs and certain things. And I actually think, I personally think that's really what I'm hoping maybe you guys can all sort of help do together, is, like, raise that conversation to a higher level. What bothers me is there being this informational asymmetry. So I may understand, I was using this example earlier with Chuck, like Facebook asks me when I install an app, they say, I want to use your, I want access to your friends and I want to know your location. And I know conceptually what I'm giving them, but I don't really know tangibly what that exchange is, right? I don't know the economics. So they could use that location data to know where I live, know where I work. Maybe just that information alone means that they can predict when I'm getting sick, you know, because I'm staying home more, my insurance rate, everyone always uses the insurance rates going up. So it's the evil thing that can happen, right? I'm not saying that that's, I'm not even saying that that's bad. I just want to know what I'm giving up. You know, I want to be aware of that. If to make that decision, I want the full information. So one thing I think we should do more is raise people's sort of awareness about the, about what your data could be used for. The problem is like no one knows all of it yet. And who knows what new technology is going to come out 2 years from now that when combined with that innocuous data is going to produce something you had unintended consequences. So that's tricky. There was another point I was going to make, now I'm forgetting. I think the other is merely that like I do think anonymity is pretty much dead. I mean, they're, and I'm maybe okay with that. Like, I was writing a report that a chair, like the new cars that are coming out, are going to have five pressure sensors in the seat. So just based on the unique way that you sit in the seat, it will identify the driver, so it can automatically adjust to you. If it's, you know, you can set control, so if it's your 16-year-old kid, they can only drive during certain hours, won't turn on. Like, there's just, we're not unique snowflakes, and there's so many recording things around that it's unavoidable. Like, it's going to be so easy to figure out who people are. The question shouldn't be, how do we walk back from that? It should be, how do we act in that world such that we preserve the values that we all care about? And how do we make that? It's not an easy answer, but I think it's much more productive than saying, like, don't. Like, a do not sense list. There's that. How would you even do that?
So let's end there, actually, on that somewhat positive
note. Oh, positive note is that the world is full of opportunities, and there's more good that's going to come from that data than bad.
And then pretty much coming in exchange.